Hey Rachel, how are you? Hey.
I'm well, Matt. How are you?
I'm good. For those who are regular viewers of the Weekend Blogs, we have Rachel Sklar, who's sitting in, filling in for Bill today. And you're coming from O'Hare Airport, is that right?
I am, yes, and I have no idea how the sound is going to work here, and I have no idea generally if this is working at all, but I chose a little corner. And I set up, and yeah, so we'll
That's
see if this works. I'm just waiting to fly back to New York. I'm speaking at a conference.
the jet setting lifestyle.
Yes,
So
very jet set.
now what's interesting is, Rachel and I, who you are, by the way, my favorite Canadian, we used to do a lot of TV together, right? MSNBC quite often, and then sort of haven't done that in a long time, but there for a while we almost like we should have gotten our own show, I thought.
I know. Well, here we are reunited, and it feels so good. I still see you
Yeah.
on a couple from time to time. It's
Yeah.
always a pleasure.
I think I'm sort of like the curse, because like I was on the 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue show last week, and then the next day I hear that they're canceling it, or Ed Schultz is going to be replacing David
Got in
Shuster
just
in
under
that
the wire.
spot. So yeah. So, well, anyway, I wanted to go ahead and get started, and Rachel, you're a prolific Twitterer,
I
and
am.
you are, and I'm
But
on
now that
Twitter
I
too,
don't
so
have Eat the Press anymore, I need a place to park my deep thoughts.
yeah. So I wanted to talk. Bill Buettler, who writes for The Next Right, had an interesting take on why Republicans are sort of dominating in Twitter, and he had an interesting take that it was something pretty simplistic, hashtags, that conservatives have, like, the hashtag life or TCOT, which is top conservative on Twitter. That makes it more
Right, yes.
searchable or whatnot. And he argues at The Next Right that hashtags are why Republicans are doing better on Twitter.
Well, I don't know if it's a question of doing better on Twitter. I think we can, I mean, what, I mean, TCOT, is that the TCOT? That's, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to fix the screen because the sun just angled in. O'Hare is actually really pretty airport. I wouldn't say that they're doing better on Twitter. They're definitely, that's definitely a very well-used hashtag, and I think
Yeah.
that being, recognizing that as Twitter, basically as Twitter becomes more used, and there's more content on there, obviously what becomes important is learning how to organize that content and learning how to game the organization of that content. So just as we saw SEO start to become more and more important on Google in terms of getting things to come up in search and being able to sort of maximize your content within the search engine, we're going to see people learning how to do that on Twitter. So, yeah, the hashtag TCOT, that is a well-used hashtag, and conservatives have been smart to
Yeah.
make that known and to sort of really use that. And that's a way of tagging your information and getting it to other like-minded people. But as far as sort of like winning the Twitter war, I think it's probably pretty early to say that, particularly since, for so many people, Twitter is about who you follow.
Yeah.
So, for example, I
And what's
don't
your
follow that many
you're just
people, but
at
that
Rachel Sklar, right? I'm
I'm sorry,
at
yes.
MattLewis01, you're at Rachel Sklar.
Yeah, and I follow you.
As thank you, and I follow you back, or I think I might have followed
Awesome.
you first. I'm stalking. As a blogger, the thing that I've sort of noticed about Twitter is, because now I'm writing for AOL's Politics Daily, and well, we didn't really do the proper introduction. Rachel, I guess when I first met you were with Huffington Post. Is
Right, I
that's
was doing
correct?
the Eat the Press call in there. I was at HuffPo for 2.5 years.
Gotcha. Now you're sort of out of the blogging game per se now, right?
Well, it's sort of you don't parse it down anymore. At least I don't feel I do. I don't blog every day in the same way I did at HuffPo. I have a blog at Tumblr. I have a charity blog called Charitini that I'm using to promote charity, but it also is a place to park my personal stuff. And I Twitter, and I write for the Daily Beast. Mainly, I've been working with Dan Abrams at his media consulting firm, Abrams Research. So
Oh,
basically,
cool.
I'm multitasking a lot these days.
Well, I've noticed, because at Politics Daily, unlike when I was at I'm still at Town Hall, but when I was writing all the time at Town Hall, it was very acceptable at Town Hall to put up just like quick little tidbits, like check this out. At Politics Daily, you're sort of expected to write a more longer sort of thought out piece, not just, hey, check this out. So what I've done is I'm basically all those short little things that I used to write, I'm now doing on Twitter, which I think maybe is that sort of, do you think that's happening? I assume that I'm not the only one who's sort of like, if it's something quick, I don't take the time to put it on the blog anymore. I just tweet it out. So
tweet it out. Yo.
I tweet it out. But, you know, I mean, so the downside to that is I don't get, like, page views or ad impressions where I'm writing at. You know, it goes out into the Twitter world. The upside is it's probably quicker and easier for me, and I think it's probably almost a broader audience probably because it's, you know, it goes to all of my followers. So it's hard to say. Is the short blog dead?
It's funny that you say, when you said that the downside of it, I thought you were going to say is that I really can't explore the nuances and really think out the logical conclusions of each and every issue, but instead you went to page views and ad revenue. So thinking like
well,
a monetizing
you know, I mean, you know, the suits always insist on finding ways to monetize things.
Well, I think, you know, for me, it's funny because no one would have ever accused me of being a brief, you know, a quick writing blogger on Eat the Press. I definitely wrote a lot and in many cases overwrote. So I really like the fact that Twitter forces me to keep it short. I do think that a lot of people, and I've seen this, actually I went to South by Southwest and I did see someone write something, probably saw it on Twitter, about how there were a lot less blog posts about South by Southwest and obviously a lot more tweets about it and things being live tweeted. There's no point in live blogging something if you're live tweeting it and all of that. So
exactly.
I think that, you know, this is the way information is just parsing itself out, and you know, we're still in the middle of seeing that happen. So, but I don't think that's a conservative thing or a liberal thing.
Long,
I think that now everybody goes
on
Twitter.
I agree. If I have something long to write, like really long, I'll blog it. If I have something short, then I tweet it. Whereas I used to would in the old days, I would have put it up on the blog. And I think you're right on with live blogging. It's pretty much dead, I think, right?
I don't know about dead, but it definitely feels like, you know, for a while, especially during the election, there was so much live blogging going on, and of all the debates and all the you know, the primary nights and stuff like that, and that's for a real dedicated audience. But at the same time, what's good about all the sort of live tweeting and the as it happens stuff is that it really does create a record for you to go back to, and which I do think is very valuable. You know, you can change a timestamp on a blog, and many people have. Many people change a timestamp to, you know, make like they were up at, you know, 6 a.m. posting that thing. But
you've never been guilty of something like that, have you?
Never.
So so one of the stories that I know you wanted to talk about, and it's kind of breaking this week on the blogs, is the Iowa case, court case about same-sex marriage. You want to go ahead and get us started on that, and then I'll talk about what some of the bloggers are saying about it.
Well, you know, it's the legalization of gay marriage. It's a good thing. I know that that's a conservative viewpoint right now.
Well, I mean, here's the interesting thing about it. Without getting into the actual issue per se, over at Red State, they put up a post and they linked to another site. But essentially, The idea was that politically, this helps, like Huckabee and Palin, going into Iowa, for example, because it's a twofer. You can talk about sort of activist judges, and you could also use it to talk about the gay marriage issue and the social. I will say this: I don't think the culture wars ever disappear; they go dormant. And I'm really surprised because I think Obama and liberals greatly benefited from the social issues essentially going away. And I swear it's almost like Obama and Obama wasn't behind this one, but with stem cell research, with gays in the military, it's almost like he doesn't want to like accept the fact that, wow, it's great to have people focusing on something else. It's almost like they're going out of their way to reinvigorate social conservatives.
Well, I mean, that is something that I definitely noticed during the election, because I was very attuned to the debate over the Supreme Court and the fact that the next president was going to be naming, you know, in all probability,
right.
like multiple justices, and I was waiting for that to explode. And I wrote something on that in, I think it was May, and then Jeff Toobin had written something about that for the New Yorker that I spoke to him about, and I thought it was just going to be such a big issue, and it just never really hit. And so, you know, the whole Roe versus Wade abortion thing, it never really happened. There had been a speech McCain had made around May, and there had been some coded references in there about activist judges and legislating from the bench and that sort of thing, and I really was expecting that to explode, and it just didn't. So.
Right. Well,
yeah,
I mean, problem is you can't, if you're a conservative, you can't go back to the well every 4 or 2 years and get people fired up. Eventually, people
really?
Don't get
you
fired
can't?
Up. Apparently, we couldn't last year. But my point is, like, the only time social conservatives are effective, in my opinion, as a political force is never when they try to be proactively. It's when they react to liberal overreaching. And so a great example would be, you know, Gavin Newsom, you know, right in 2004 out in San Francisco started, you know, marrying gay couples, which went against the law. And it was a great issue. It actually sort of reinvigorated social conservatives and, you know,
well,
arguably...
I mean, can't you argue that the Prop 8 no is doing the same thing? Like, I think that probably a lot more people have been activated or activized based on surprise. I mean, I think people really did think that, you know, the Prop 8 thing wasn't going to be an issue in California. People were really stunned that it ended up being one. So
I really think Obama was doing very well sort of saying those issues, they're 20th century issues, and we've moved past that now. And besides, and he appealed, you know, he won the Catholic vote this time, you know, and Obama, you know, Bush won it in 2004, Obama won the Catholic vote in 2008, and I think it wasn't because, it was essentially because he said, those issues are great, but we're not going to keep fighting the, you know, 1960s, 1970s battles anymore, this is a new era, and yet I feel like we may be sort of on the cusp of. And by the way, let me say, I do read the comments at the Blogging Heads TV, and one of the criticisms of me is that I'm always sort of looking for these trends that will put Republicans back in power. And so this may or may not happen, but it clearly is another example of me trying to divine what might be a long-term trend that most people are ignoring and don't even see right now. So,
I don't think there's anything wrong with looking at things going on and trying to extrapolate towards the potential that they may have going forward. I think that's smart, you know, and gives you bragging rights if they actually happen. So,
and if you make enough predictions, some of them will come true.
well, that's true, yeah. You know, Thomas Friedman every 6 months, et cetera. But I think, you know, I mean, I don't think that the culture wars go away. I do think that they evolve, and so gay marriage is the next big thing, one of the next big things, and it's just becoming more and more ridiculous, in my view, that, you know, it's an issue. You've got, there's really no good, strong, smart, viable reason to keep loving, committed unions from being recognized by law. I think Alex was talking about the state of the blogosphere. Alex Falk, former Gopher editor, a really smart guy on his Tumblr weblog, pointed out, I guess he quoted something about how conservatives were upset because they were worried about protecting families. And he said, protecting them from what? And I think that's the issue. You know, protecting families from what? From a slice of the population which historically is a lot more affluent and a lot more stable, raising and nurturing children.
Well, I would say this. I mean, I would disagree with you in terms of the fact that I do not support gay marriage. I think you do. But I think you make a very good point in terms of the political difficulties of that conservatives face making this argument. And I'll go back to something I said earlier. I think conservatives have been effective, social conservatives have been effective, not when they have proactively tried to start something, but when something has been thrust on them. You could argue that this court case is an example of that, but I think a better example is, like, say, when Christian kids try to give a prayer during a commencement speech, and they're not allowed to, and they become the victims. That's a much more clear-cut case and a much easier political way to rally. This is a tougher issue, I think.
Sure, and it's also
and the other thing
that
is studies
well, for the
that,
reasons for it, the reasons against it, or not. You know, you can articulate all of the facts and all of the rationality-based decisions in favor of it, but the real elephant in the room is homophobia. And so people, you know, that's where the gut reaction is coming from. I just do think that there has been, like, a slow but sure sea change in the tide of homophobia in this country and really in the world. It's just, you know, it's just not the same large chunk of people don't regard being gay as being different and threatening anymore as they used to. And I think, like, for example, you know, movies like Milk go a long way towards demonstrating that.
Well, and that's why I've always thought that the best propaganda is that which does not appear to be propaganda. You know, conservatives who make these overt political documentaries, people know they're political, but a film like Milk is actually very effective because it appears to be just a movie, and it lionizes this character. I'd love it if they make a great movie about, you know, a blockbuster sort of Hollywood movie celebrating, say, the life of, I don't know, pick some conservative hero, you know, Charlton Heston.
No, you pick some conservative hero, because I think that, you know, I think Harvey Milk deserves to be lionized. I mean, I think that you know, the character as portrayed in the film and responding to sort of the social forces that were happening in that film, that's, you know, I'm down with it. So
no, I'm just saying, I mean, there's all these movies, the people,
another
classic example is, like, The People versus Larry Flint, which turns a pornographer into this First Amendment hero. Hollywood is very good at making movies to turn their activists into heroes.
The First Amendment is
It's very effective. It's very effective, and I just wish, you know, there's some, you know, we did have Wilberforce. Yeah, I guess the guy has to be dead for a couple hundred years before he gets a movie. So, have you seen Amazing Grace about William Wilberforce? I think conservatives and liberals can celebrate that.
All right, I'm coming up blank. Sorry. And I didn't see Larry Flint either. So
I did at the movies.
Courtney Love's Oscar dress, and it was lovely.
So, okay, well, we'll probably have to agree to disagree on that topic, although I think we do agree in many ways.
So I'm not quite sure. Yeah, I'm not quite sure that the, like, First Amendment cases are completely analogous, because the First Amendment does tend to be so difficult because, you know, of the type of speech that is protected. Like, it's the whole, that maxim that is attributed to Voltaire, which I'm not entirely sure he actually said, which is, I may hate them, paraphrasing, I may not agree with what you say, but I defend to the death your right to say it. So there's, you know, and then, of course, there are obviously have to be limitations on that, and that was a fun part of law school, anyhow.
All right. Well,
I'm sorry, by the way, to viewers, for the fact that this is, I keep on shaking this camera. It's just that the sun, I wasn't anticipating the sun being an issue when I set up here.
I think it might, you know what the problem is, you might be starting a trend. We may have to, like, now go on location to, like, have that hip, you know, shaky camera sort of background. Like, I might have to film this, like, in downtown D.C. next week, because Rachel did it, and there were people walking behind her, and it was cool, so.
I'm going to interview that lady with the bag there. See her? Where is she? That lady.
By the way, I apologize. How messy, could this office be any messier behind me? It's ridiculous. All right, I had one more blog piece to talk about, and then if you have anything, or if you want to, any other topics you want to talk about. But, you know, there was a blog over at Race for 2012 that just made fun of Barack Obama's giving an iPod to the Queen.
Right.
And the funny thing about this blog at Race for 2012, formerly Race for 08, is the headline. It was something like gift, and then the number 4, and then you. And so they were just sort of mocking. You know, look, I mean, we're giving this Queen, I think she's met 11 presidents. She's obviously older. She's, you know, a queen, there, it's a very formal, when you're a queen, it's literally a very, very formal thing. And you know, Barack Obama is giving her an iPod.
Oh, come on, you don't think the queen is Twittering right now? At queen? Just kidding. Go ahead.
Well, it's, look, he has a weird thing with giving people gifts. I mean, you know, I think... Yeah. What was it, Gordon Brown or somebody gave him, you know, a really nice, like, leather-bound book by, you know, Winston Churchill's, and Obama gives him these, you know, DVDs that don't even play in British, you know. So what's up with
that? Yes,
what's
that was a gap. But I don't have that. I mean, I think that, listen, if the best you can do for trying to criticize him is that was a lame gift... I don't know. I actually think it was a very cool idea, a very nice
really?
Idea.
Really? Wow.
You know, and it contained images from her last visit to the States. It contained all sorts of show tunes. Like, I'm sorry, Matt, I don't know if you know this about me, but you will never, ever, ever get me on the wrong side of show tunes. Like, I just think that was an awesome gift. I may take a little bit of issue with the selection just because it was quite conventional, but it was a really nice, it was a really lovely gift. There's, like, a lot of classics on there and threw in, you know, even threw in some Lloyd Webber, you know, as a homage to the fact that musical theater also is a robust British tradition. But, you know, musical theater is a huge part of Americana.
It just strikes me as weird, and that's what makes me, like, it's you know, it's a fine gift. I wouldn't mind receiving it, but I'm not, like, a 70-year-old woman who's royalty.
I mean, 70-year-old,
that's it strikes
music
me
from
as
her
odd.
Time, you know? That's music from her time.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that, you know, does the Queen really need another leather band book? I don't know. If I were the Queen, I'd be like, wow, score. I think that the bigger thing about the whole Obama's visit to the Queen thing was the whole, you know, hug gate, back touch gate. Like, how does the Queen wish to be touched?
Right. And well, the other thing was him... When? While you're talking about the gates, I mean, and Michelle Malkin and a lot of other conservative bloggers and had these pictures of Obama bowing to this, you know, Afghani king or whatever. I'm sorry, Saudi king. And there were, then they showed the pictures of George W. Bush, remember, holding hands with him. Did you see this picture of Obama bowing, though?
I didn't. I know that, well, you know, Bush was always a little bit more romantic with world needs leaders. I remember he gave Angela Merkel a massage.
I think it's weird to hold hands and to bow. But here's the thing, though. There's this undercurrent now, and I wrote about this last week and I talked about it, of the you know, now that Republicans are out of power, they've become like civil libertarians again.
Right.
And
well,
now
particularly since the economy is going to hell.
Yeah, and Obama's like nationalizing and big government, you know, Big
right.
Brother
so I'm
is
pushing
back.
This around again.
But one of the problems, this sort of plays into the whole thing about American sovereignty. Having an American president bow to a king of another country, I don't know that that's a good political move.
Without knowing the actual circumstances or whether or not that's just, you know, the equivalent of a handshake, you know, I think that probably... My educated guess is that probably he was briefed on, you know, the diplomatic niceties
yeah.
of that country. I don't know. I think that bowing is as a gesture. I think whether or not it's backed up by being
yeah.
craven in your dealings with them. I'd much rather see strength in the dealing than in the initial greeting. So.
That's a good. Have you seen the John Adams HBO specials yet?
No,
movies?
I'm terrible. I'm Canadian. It doesn't resonate the same way.
Well,
but,
you know,
they did well.
Well, there's a scene where when you know he becomes like a diplomat to Britain, and so Adams, it's very funny because he has to, like, sort of be deferential and bow to the king, and he has to be sort of taught by the king's, you know, handlers how, like, what you're supposed to do. So it strikes me maybe Obama was schooled the same way.
I'm so sorry. I haven't sort of read the I just haven't read the conservative blogosphere as closely as you, so I totally missed that. I clearly have to check my Twitter hashtag a little bit better. I also clearly have to see John Adams. But you know, I have seen 1776, the musical, which I don't think was on
really
this week's iPod. But
sing too?
Do I sing? Sing well enough. Put it this way, the day job is essential. How's that? But I'll rock the mic at karaoke.
Awesome.
I don't need to be convinced. So.
All right. Did you have anything else you wanted to bring up or talk about that you thought
I
was
did.
Happening
I,
this week?
Even though I don't want to end on such a somber note, but I do want to talk about the Binghamton tragedy after the shooting.
Yeah.
And just, you know, my first thought about that was, you know, A, like, wow, another one. And B, about what a non-issue the notion of gun control and, greater regulation of illegal handguns and all of that was in the election. I remember after the shooting at NIU, because it happened, I remember wondering, you know, because this happened in Illinois, and it had just happened. I think there was something like five school shootings in a week, and I'm including in the terrible one, I think it was in Germany. So this is not an isolated thing. And I remember Charlie Gibson went down to cover it and to interview Obama, but
mm-hmm.
never the twain did meet. There was actually no question for Obama about guns and gun control. And I remember it only came up during one debate, and it was only posed to Biden and Richardson. And this is something I wrote about it at the time at Eat the Press. It was about a year ago, and it just hit me again that,
yeah.
You know, when are people going to stop tiptoeing around guns and the right to bear arms and, you know, controls on guns? Because it's becoming more and more obvious that there do need to be greater controls, greater regulations.
Well, I would, again, just like the other issues, I mean, we could actually sit here and debate that, and I think we would have very, very differing viewpoints. But I think that let's leave that to somewhere else. I think the interesting sort of thing isn't whether gun control is good or, in my opinion, completely unconstitutional. but the question is,
it's so funny, we were just talking about free speech. Like, if there are going to be
legitimate
constraints on freedom of speech, then why should there not be similar, you know, for the greater good constraints on the right to bear arms? So.
No, I mean, I don't know that, like, XXX pornography constitutes free speech. But I do know that the right to bear arms constitutes the right to bear arms.
Right.
Clearly.
And to defend yourself and defend your life and your family and all of that, I get it.
Right.
But there is the question of, you know, you can a law-abiding citizen can avail themselves of that right and do so, you know, through legitimate controls. Like, when you think about how much paperwork you have to go through to get through any sort of daily function, like to get your driver's license or to, you know, to just any sort of bureaucratic taxes, like the amount of forms you got to fill out and checks that got to be run, I mean, it should be about 5 zillion times harder to get a gun. You should not, you know, and there's the whole gun show rule where it's easier, you know, you can buy a gun at a gun show without the same constraints as you would in a store. I mean, this is just, and I think Mayor Bloomberg has been an amazing leader on this. And
the interesting thing about this story isn't the story itself as much as it is that clearly Democrats, one of the problems that Republicans have is almost a victim of our own success in some ways. We have been very successful at either winning issues and in some cases getting them taken off the table. So Democrats clearly have decided they're not going to touch the gun issue. They've conceded it because they've lost so many elections and they said, look, this is just one issue. We're not gonna, you know, we're not gonna be involved in it. We're not gonna be portrayed because we've lost too many elections. We want to win. Democrats are like, we want to win Virginia. We want to win states like Virginia, and Obama did. And as soon as they change their tone and start going back, you're going to see Democrats like Heath Shuler in North Carolina losing. You're going to see Republicans elected in governorships in Virginia again, which may happen anyway with Terry McAuliffe gets the nomination in Virginia. So I guess my point is, it is the interesting part of this debate is that Democrats have conceded. They don't want to touch the gun issue.
Yeah, and that's that to me is a problem. I think that I would really like for people to be troubled enough by this stuff happening to say, okay, how can we both honor the Constitution and put steps in place so that this doesn't happen again, or this can't happen so easily? Because, you know, marveling after the fact that someone could go to a pawn shop and buy a gun, just, you know, or someone with a history of mental illness, someone who people after the fact say, like, oh, yeah, I remember that guy. He talked about how he had a gun in his glove compartment and another one at home. Like, that's...
I'll be very interesting to see because, you know, right now everybody wants to talk about the schisms on the right. But there's a lot of stuff happening on the left right now. You've got issues where Code Pink was attacked this week in Politico by, you know, Marcos Melitzas and Barney Frank. We've got issues where, you know, Move On is fighting.
That's because the country's on a spectrum.
Move On is fighting, right? with what's that?
Well, that's because the country's a spectrum. You know, not everybody is as extreme or steadfast to one side or the other, you know, as everybody else. It's like, you know, when we started this and when you sent me the list of issues and you said, what's happening with the Netroots? And I was like, I don't really know what's happening to Netroots. I never thought of myself as a Netroots. And, you know, a year ago, I certainly wouldn't have been aligned with the Netroots because let's just say that I was a lot more supportive of Hillary Clinton and defensive of how she was being treated a year ago,
right,
than people, others in the Netroots were. So I think
But I guess
that
what I'm saying, though, is that the mainstream
media...
It's not a
monolith on either side.
The mainstream media is really playing up the divisions on the right, you know, Rush Limbaugh versus Michael Steele or whatever. But what is not being widely reported is that there are real fights taking place on the left. Evan Bayh, Chris Van Hollen versus Move On. And my point is, this gun issue
that you're talking about. With respect,
I would love to
Rush
see liberal
Limbaugh
waters
versus Michael Steele is like a little bit more A, interesting, and B, relevant, and C, high profile than sort of squabbling happening.
Yeah. Well, I would love to see liberal bloggers fight it out over why Democrats aren't pushing gun control. Because I hope they start pushing gun control.
I've already Twittered about
because
it.
Because they're
going to
start losing elections when they do.
Maybe I'll start Twittering and using the TCOT hashtag.
You should do that.
That happens.
Me and
All
you
right,
could you
I
could
will.
Start a whole thing. Now, I guess the last thing that I know you wanted to talk about, and maybe it's a
yeah,
good thing
yeah,
to close on.
Yeah, because I also have like 3 minutes because of my plane. I can't miss my plane.
Is this so. Ross Douthat, if I'm pronouncing
yeah.
his name correctly. What's your take on him going to the New York Times to take over the Bill Kristol spot?
You know, well, you're giving me an easy opening here. It's not like he could do any worse. It's not like his columns could be any less inspiring, fact-based, interesting, relevant. No, he's a very good writer, and he's a smart writer, and his stuff at The Atlantic was great. And I think, you know, kudos to the New York Times for getting some new and young blood. I think it's smart. I'm looking forward to seeing what he'll do.
If people want to know why conservatives are not excited about Ross, it is because Rachel Sklar and more liberal bloggers like him. And I'm not
no,
saying
I
that,
like someone
not,
who puts forth an argument
why,
and then
but it's
says
indicative
what
of
like.
Why.
You know, I just like someone who puts forth an argument. I don't always have to agree, but I really just like an argument that I can agree with or disagree with, but I can do so based on the facts. And
right.
And that's and,
but
and
see,
he does that. He's a good thinker. So.
Here's the problem though with having Ross in this position. And first of all, let me say, no sour grapes. I think Rich Lowry or somebody like Rich Lowry should have been. That's who I would have supported or liked. Going to the New York Times, but
well, hopefully
Ross,
Rich will get a platform.
Ross is the
soon.
Kind of Ross is the kind of conservative that could get a job at the New York Times because they don't really want – he is what they think conservatism is because he's what conservatism is if you live in New York City and you know, hang out at those cocktail parties and whatnot.
Wow, I had no idea there were such rifts and schisms between the conservative movement.
But no, he's not part of the conservative movement. So, I mean, he's what the New York Times thinks conservatism is. And so here's the problem, though. The reason it matters is whenever you have a show like, say, Meet the Press, and they want to have a token conservative on, because they usually have – the host is usually a liberal, and they usually have two or three liberal guests, and then they'll throw in –
You are so opening up a topic of conversation that is going to take more than the 1 minute I have.
Okay, I'm sorry.
To get to the gate.
We should – to
okay?
be continued. And you're so much better looking than Bill. I think everyone can agree with that. Bill's a handsome man, mind you, but Rachel, you are a patriot.
My airport garb is unsurpassable.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us, and we should do it again.
Yes, it's really nice to talk to you again, and thanks, Matt. And viewers, I really do apologize for the wobbliness of the screen and all the stuff we had going on, so sorry about that.
All right. Well, have a safe flight, and we will see you soon.
Okay. Thanks, Matt. Take care.
Okay.
Bye.